Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's announcement yesterday of a troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, in effect the unsurge of the extra 30,000 troops Obama deployed. To get an analysis of the beginning of the end of this decade-long war, we will be joined by AFPAC expert Christine Fair, who served as a United Nations political officer in Kabul and is a senior fellow in the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Then we'll get a broader analysis of the Middle East, shaken by the Arab Spring revolutions, and assess the successes and failures, as well as focusing on the counter-revolutionaries, in particular the contra of contras, Saudi Arabia, the oil-rich reactionary feudal state that fuels religious medievalism and abhors democracy. Anwar Boukaris, an expert on the Middle East, and in particular Morocco, where the Moroccan king is doing exactly what the Saudi king is urging and trying to bribe him not to do, joins us. Then finally, we'll get an update on the financial crisis shaking the Eurozone, which is concerned over Greece's defaulting on its stifling debt and Portugal and Ireland staggering under the weight of their debts. Stephen Hill, the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age, joins us from a conference of European leaders in Spain, where these issues are being discussed, debated, and presumably dealt with. Joining us now is Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include Treading Softly on Sacred Ground, Counterinsurgency Operations on Sacred Space, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security. She is security assistant. She's also a senior fellow with the counterterrorism at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And the President's address yesterday, where he announced the sort of unsurge, if you will, beginning with 5,000 troops, do you think this is the beginning of the end of this decades-long war, which increasingly I think the American people consider a losing cause?
I think that's too hard to say, because I don't think anyone is saying that we're going to completely disengage from Afghanistan. I think there is an interest in maintaining a training mission there. You know, the capabilities of the Afghan National Security Forces is really seen as the strategy to get out more or less completely in terms of kinetic military activities, and have a more normalized relationship with that country, where we do the kinds of things that we do elsewhere, which is, you know, continuing military-to-military cooperation, anti-narcotics, human development, and things of this nature.
So I spoke a couple of days ago with Graham Fuller, who's one of the few former officials, former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and former station chief in Kabul. He actually speaks Arabic, and he was suggesting that the real problem all along has been our footprint in the Middle East, and by reducing the footprint, it can only get better. Do you share that view or that optimism?
Well, I'm not sure that question has to do with Afghanistan.
Well, it actually had a lot to do with Pakistan, in fact.
Well, I don't really quite get that either. I mean, the issue with the Pakistanis right now is really the presence of the United States in Afghanistan, and most importantly, the cooperation that the Pakistani military has had with the United States. This has been a source of disgruntlement within the Pakistan Army, and also, across broad strata of Pakistani society. And recent events, such as the bin Laden raid, has really been humiliating for Pakistan. So what goes on in the Gulf really has less salience. I mean, obviously, there's a Palestine issue. I mean, Pakistanis broadly detest our policies and with respect to Israel and our failure to really make the Israelis understand the nature of our policy, which is anti-settlement. But then again, I'm opposed to our current policy. But all of those long-standing issues of disgruntlement have really been displaced, quite frankly, by current events and the unhappiness and really simmering outrage about the U.S. relationship with Pakistan and the terms on which that relationship is framed.
Well, I actually, that is what Graham Fuller was talking about. He was talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan with, you know, and with a reference to Iraq, perhaps. But essentially, the idea that Pakistan, what is tearing Pakistan apart is the presence of this war going on and this deployment of U.S. Military there, and that the tenuous hold that they had on the Fatah is being is now turning back to bite them, if you will, and that they wouldn't be in the country would not be as insecure and anti-American as it is today, but for what is going on next door. That was not a very good summary of what he was saying, but
But I don't entirely agree with that either. I mean, the issue with Fatah is not just that there is dislike for the war in Afghanistan. The issue is that Fatah had always been, let me say, always been a sanctuary for different militant organizations. This isn't new. More to the point about the non-newness of this, even the Pakistan Taliban are in many instances Pakistan's proxies gone wild. The elements of the TPP that are most vicious are drawn from these Deobandi groups that had really long been clients of the state. And Pakistan's unwillingness to go after other elements, such as the anti-Shia groups, because they have overlapping membership with Kashmiri groups. So it's not as straightforward to say that they hate us because of Afghanistan. It's a much more complex admission than that. And the other interesting thing is that the Pakistan Taliban are using this as an opportunity to transform Pakistani society. So, for example, for the first time in Pakistan's history, militant groups have targeted Sikhs. And the reason for that is that they're not considered by these Deobandi groups to be real Muslims. So there are real issues here that have very little, if anything, to do with Afghanistan. And it has much more to do, I can say that. Part of this problem is the unresolved debate about Pakistani identity and who Pakistan is for. And these structural questions are considerably exacerbated by what's happening in Afghanistan.
And is that to say that Pakistan was formed as a sanctuary for Muslims, and therefore that is the core of their identity?
Yeah, but so there's always been this long-standing debate about Islam and the state and the relationship thereof. It's never been a great thing to be a non-Muslim in Pakistan. But what you see happening increasingly is a different phenomenon. It's a question of what kind of Islam is appropriate for the Pakistani state. And so this is where you run into things like the Pakistan Taliban going after these Sufi shrines. And so it used to be, is it Muslim or is it not Muslim? Then it evolved under Zia al-Haq to be, it's not good to be a Shia. So in other words, you have to be a Sunni. And now what we see happening is it's not enough to just be Sunni, but there are particular sects within Sunni Islam that is the desirable identity in Pakistan. And listen, this is Pakistan's war, and Pakistan is taking this identity war very seriously, and most importantly, they own it. Pakistanis know full well that they're in a fight to save what they think was Jinnah's vision for Pakistan, and the issue is what the United States does makes that very difficult for them.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's also senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. But I understand, Chris Fair, that there is a burning and increasing anger and hatred amongst the junior officer corps towards the United States and towards their own leadership. I believe that the general in charge, Kayani, has been under a lot of pressure, and he's had to go around and speak and placate a lot of the units in control, and that the Pakistan military has been somewhat humiliated on television and in the popular culture. So given the old joke that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country, how does that play out in terms of the long simmering competition between, you know, military dictatorships and civilian kleptocracies?
Okay, so where does one begin with that? First of all, it's not just the junior officers. The Pakistan Army has been deeply ambivalent about the U.S. military and increasingly, as you noted, actively hostile. Some people will talk about the lost generation stemming from our military cutoff in 1990. It actually goes back much earlier to 1962 when the Americans armed the Indians against their war with China. Our decision to not help them in their 65 war with India, our ambivalent response to the 71 war when Pakistan was dismembered by India. And then, of course, you have the period of the sanctions, you know, from 1990 onward in particular. Although it is important to note that non-proliferation sanctions were first applied in April of 1979. Most people don't appreciate that. So there has been longstanding antipathy towards the Americans. It's now really untenable. I mean, the Pakistanis really want out of this relationship. Now, I don't think Kayani is in the kind of trouble that is being portrayed. I mean, this is, I think, a creation, an opportunity to create leverage that the Americans want Kayani to stay in there for reasons that are perhaps not entirely clear to me. But they want him to stay. And so when he says that I'm under pressure, you know, après moi le deluge, it's also meant as a lever by which they can get the Americans to back off. And they want the Americans to back off. They actually want the Americans out of Afghanistan. They really want the Americans out of Pakistan. And that's increasingly because their intelligence agency, the ISI, and our intelligence agency, the CIA, we're working at cross purposes. I mean, the CIA is probably targeting the ISI more these days, and they're actually working with it.
So to the broader question that was brought up by Graham Fuller, the Pakistanis clearly think they would be better off and Afghanistan would be better off if the U.S. got out. Would we be better off? That's the key question.
Well, look, we've had this discussion before on previous shows.
Sure.
I don't think that this strategy of a big counterinsurgency footprint really fixes the issue. I mean, by virtue of our being there, everyone talks about the security gains, the hard-won security gains, and Helmand and Kandahar. But what officials don't talk about is the fact that in the rest of the country, security is degraded. It's like a water balloon, right? We squeeze it in Kandahar and Helmand, which are adjacent, and security situation arises elsewhere. Regional Command East, which is where the Haqqani network runs around, it's become more dangerous. So it's almost disingenuous to talk about security gains in one part of Afghanistan while not talking about what's happened elsewhere. And then, quite frankly, our only legitimate security issue or concern is whether or not al-Qaeda or other organizations will use Afghanistan as a base for international terrorism. Now, listen, they're not the only country that has the potential for being a sanctuary. There are a number of countries that are a sanctuary, both because of state ineptitude and mostly state ineptitude and their inability to deal with these groups. But you've got Pakistan, you've got Somalia, you've got Yemen. Clearly, the approach to handling international terrorist threats is not to send 130,000 troops, international and American, to contend with the problem. This is not a scalable, workable, sustainable, affordable solution.
So is there a sustainable, affordable solution?
Yeah, I mean, you actually finally see people coming around to this in Congress and elsewhere. You know, for several years now, I've been a proponent of Counterterrorism Plus, And this, I think, satisfies a lot of issues. One, we negotiate a status of forces agreement with the Afghan government. This gets away of, this basically takes away the insurgents' claim that we're an occupying force, because the status of forces agreement would basically subject U.S. forces to Afghan government sovereignty. It would continue a training mission of Afghan National Security Forces. Karzai and any other president will want that, because they're, those ANSF forces are what's going to keep those guys safe. And in exchange, we will want access to military bases, whether it be on a collaborative, cooperative, rental basis, so that we can continue keeping an eye on al-Qaeda. Incidentally, there is no Afghan leader that wants al-Qaeda to come back. So, in some sense, counterterrorism plus, I think, is the best way forward. And there is the real question about the Taliban's relationship with al-Qaeda. Mullah Omar's relationship was with bin Laden, not with Zawahiri. So I think one of the canards that conservatives and other proponents of this indefinite commitment to a counterinsurgency footprint has really been vitiated by the death of bin Laden.
Well, we know, Chris Fair, that the America's mayors are weighing in on the president, saying, how come we can't fix potholes in Main Street USA, and why are we wasting all this money in Afghanistan? And one of the peculiar things that's happening domestically, politically here, is that more and more Republicans are beginning to oppose this war and perhaps make it a campaign issue. And that, of course, is ironic, given that Obama inherited Republican wars. But he did, after all, say, because he was against the Iraq war, he did say, I can do Afghanistan better. Do you think he dug a hole for himself there?
Well, I think there's a few issues about that. I think you saw campaign, the candidate Obama, he really didn't have, in the summer of 2008, a firm grasp of the region. I mean, or what was possible within the region. Some of his early missteps about bringing India into the picture, a move that I think is obviously important, was vigorously opposed by the Indian lobby. And in fact, when Holbrooke was finally announced, that wasn't in his portfolio. Yet it's a perennial issue with Pakistan and motivates much of what they do in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So I think that when Obama got into office, he had a learning curve. And I don't think he realized, I think he did come to learn very quickly that Pakistan is more important than Afghanistan. But what you never saw them do is articulate a real plan. And so what I see now happening is that our urgency to get out of Afghanistan really requires more cooperation from the Pakistanis and sustained cooperation. Yet their timeline for tolerating our continued cooperation is really diminishing.
Well, Chris Fair, I'm afraid we've run out of time here. I'd like to, again, thank you for joining us. Again, Chris Fair is a former United Nations political officer in Kabul and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Arab Spring and who are the counter-revolutionaries.